This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with a very special guest today from Spain, Oli Damgaard, who has done an extensive study of the assassination of the Swedish social democratic politician and prime minister, Olof Palme. And I think that it will have a lot of ramifications on which Oli is going to expand. Oli, it's a real pleasure to have you here on the show.
The honor is all mine, Jim. I followed you for years, and I feel really, like I said, blessed to be with you here.
Please tell us how you first became interested in the assassination of the Swedish prime minister.
It actually started with Kennedy many, many years ago when I saw the Zapruder film. I think it was in the early 1980s. And I, just like so many other people, when I saw the way his head was being thrown back and to the left, I just felt, my God, something really weird is going on here. So I became almost obsessed with trying to find out what had happened in Dallas that day. And I think I read maybe a couple of hundred books. And I think, just like you, I in the beginning I got very confused, because it seemed like one person was working for CIA in one book, and in the next book he was working for the mob, and in the other one he was paid by the FBI, and so on. I got to a point where I just felt, I'm going to write a book for myself just to be able to keep everything apart and see what is what's actually happening, because it was such a complex labyrinth of and layers of enigmas on top of each other. And then the more I looked into that, then I also started becoming interested in the assassination of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy, Abraham Lincoln, and so on. And while I was learning more and more about this, the Swedish Prime Minister, Olof Palme, was shot in February 86. And at that time, I thought that I lived in a country of beautiful democracy where the police were the good guys and everything was done the way it should be, that we were the perfect place to be and that there were no corruption and all of this. And then after a while, with all this study of the different assassinations, I started seeing a very clear pattern, almost like a template of how you make an assassination on this level and how you get away with it, how you trick the main population into believing that nothing really happened, that it was a work of a lone crazy guy. And while I was getting into the details of these templates, I mean, on the street level, there were different, the mechanics were different. It was not always the same people they used, even though the same people appeared and popped up in many different places. In the meantime, I started seeing that there were a very similar pattern in the assassination of Olof Palme as well, which was really shocking to me. I was so unprepared for that. And so I said to myself, let me check if I check the other big assassinations like JFK and so on, and see how they did it with this almost like a bullet point list. Then if I compare to the Swedish assassination, what would be their next step? And this was like a year or two after the assassination in Sweden here. So I followed the bullet point list and I said, okay, if something similar is going on in Sweden, then this would be their next step. I can't remember what that step was. Would it was be like finding another weapon or something like that? And within the next 2 weeks, exactly like I had suspected, that happened in Sweden. The so-called investigation came out and said exactly that. That really freaked me out, because I thought, oh my God, if this has happened in Chile or Argentina, I could understand it. But in Sweden, it was just absolutely mind-blowing for me. So after that, I started discovering that the country I lived in was a totally different country that I thought I grew up in. Because suddenly the police were not somebody you could trust, but they were actually part of a lot of horrible things, and that there was corruption on a very high level. And so I dropped everything. I used to work as a journalist, but I quit my job and I moved to Sweden. no, to Stockholm, I'm sorry, to see if I could really get as close as possible into the details of this assassination. And so I joined. There was a private little group of private people, mostly ex-policemen, lawyers, custom officers, businessmen. I mean, very serious, honest people that were very concerned about what was going on in Sweden. And so I spent, like, I think 2-3 years trying to learn as much as possible from these people, because they had such an immense amount of knowledge among them. So I spent years going to their home, learning from them, keeping a very, very low profile, because one of the things that I discovered early on was that if you want to survive in this game, either you need the spotlight on you big time, so you have some kind of security through that, or you need to go under the radar to be totally anonymous. And I chose the second one, because that was the path that I was on. I was more or less Mr. Nobody. So many of the people around this assassination, I tracked them down. I tracked down foreign agents. I tracked down secret police officer, some of the Swedish policemen that was part of the assassination, and so on. But I don't think they ever understood that I tracked them down, because it should have been the other way around. Anyway, that was sort of a little about the background.
Well, I think that's all quite important and extraordinary. Excuse me. I'm very interested in the patterns you discovered, the range of cases you have studied, and the variations in the different cases. If you could elaborate, Ole, begin anywhere you think is most appropriate, but the patterns are what are crucial.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. That is why I'm very passionate about exposing these so-called false flag operations, or black ops, or psyops, or whatever they're called, because this is one of their main weapons or tools when it comes to manipulating us as normal people. And as far as I've been able to figure out, they work, one of the main methods they use is what we call problem, reaction, solution. Like if you, for instance, if I was the one in power and I wanted tanks in the streets, I wanted people with weapons everywhere, I wanted the police to be able to kick in doors and whatever without a warrant. If I just forced that upon a country, I would have a massive problem, just like they had with the military takeovers in Chile and Argentina and so on, where suddenly you needed almost as many soldiers as you needed as population, and you needed police everywhere, and you would have problems with guerrilla movements and undercover groups, and you would fill it you would have to fill the prisons with people that didn't support you and so on. So that's not a clever way to do it. A clever way is that instead it's like you, the one who's the one in power, you secretly create a problem. Nobody knows that you're the one that are creating it. And this is very often in the form of a bomb. Well, let's go for a bomb for because that's one of their favorites. So, for instance, if I'm the one who wants to do this, I secretly place a bomb, and I place that in a place to get as strong a reaction from the public as possible. So I need to place it where there are lots of women, children. It doesn't work with old men or handicapped people or foreigners or anything like that. You need to go emotional. So they love like nuns and nurses and daycare centers, things like that. Awful, awful. But that is to be able to get a stronger reaction from us, the public, as possible. So before that, I prepare a patsy, and this patsy can be anything from a group of people, it has been in trends. It used to be the Eastern European ones. They used to be Russians or East Germans they liked, but then the trend went in more and more into the Muslims, and they really pushed that very hard, so that nowadays when you say Muslim, you directly connected with terrorists. You don't even think that they're separated, or Islam, it means terrorism. The two are so connected now. Lately, they've taken another step forward. Now they make these so-called terrorists be one of ourselves, blonde, northern-looking types, or American ordinary people, so meaning that you can't trust anyone. Anyway, let me get back on track. So you prepare a patsy, you prepare evidence for that person or group so that you can blame them right away as soon as the bomb or the hit or whatever it is goes off. Then the second thing you do is you wait until it's primetime TV so that you know that this will reach out big time. So this is often in the morning news, or when people are on the way to their jobs, that's when you pull this thing up. So you wait until there are lots of kids, women and so on, and then boom, off goes the bomb. Then directly you have also prepared the media so that they're ready, and they start pumping out the more horrific images, the better for them, to create a reaction. We were talking about the problem, to get a reaction, and the reaction will be from us, the normal people. Oh my God, what is happening? Something needs to be done. And then they will turn to me, the one who placed the bomb there, and said, please, we elected you, you have to do something about this. And I say, well, in order to be able to do this, I will have to put tanks in the streets, and I will have to have soldiers everywhere, and they will have to be able to kick your door in any time of the day without you being able to say that. And the population will just say, yes, please do it, put handcuffs on her, no problem, we're so happy, as long as you take care of this problem. Also, this patsy is very often a group that the people in power have problems with anyway, so they sort of hit two flies in one go. So when this bomb explodes, boom, out it goes in media to create the reaction, and then I can come forward with a solution. And then I will also push forward my solution and becoming a hero at the same time. So it's an absolute super formula that I think it was actually invented by one of the old Roman colonels. So it's been going on for many, many, many generations.
Listening to your sketch, I think of many cases, such as in Buenos Aires in 1992, the Mossad blew up the Israeli embassy and blamed it on Iran. When that didn't create enough public reaction, they attacked their own Jewish community center 2 years later in 1994, all of this in retaliation for the cooperation that the Argentine government had extended to Iran for the peaceful development of nuclear weapons. And of course, having the patsy in the wing, very, very clear cases with JFK and Oswald, Bobby and Sirhan and 9/11 and the 19, isn't that interesting, 19 Islamic terrorists. It goes on and on. So
it's just like you said, it goes on and on and on and on and on. And this is why, if this was only one case, it's one thing. But when it comes to almost in the hundreds, the pattern is very, very clear after a while. So if you want me, I can go down to the street level, how they do these attacks.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. I do, Ole.
Okay, so one of the things,
and I want you to be as detailed as you can be about each of the cases, because the pattern is so crucial. And I think if the audience hears, several of the cases you've been mentioning in some detail, they'll really appreciate the power of your analysis.
For sure, Jim. Anything you want, just if you can guide me, because these are such big areas, so it's very easy to get
well, some of the obvious cases, like JFK, yeah, might be a good place to start. JFK and, yeah, Bobby, because they seem so clearly to fit the pattern you're describing, and then we can use those as a template for looking at other cases.
Yeah, for sure. I'll give an example, just the general idea to start with. If you're going to hit someone or take someone out, what you need to do, or what they do, is very often they send in a surveillance team, and these people come in maybe 3-4 weeks at least beforehand, and they start checking out the victim to be, all his routes to and from work, where he goes, his friends, all of these things. And this surveillance team, I don't know nowadays with the high-tech thing they do, but it used to be like a team of maybe 9 people or three groups of 3. These were often connected with radio only. So this is a crucial thing in all of these things, is the need-to-know chain. They keep everybody separated so that no one can become a whistleblower. They will only know their little part in the machine.
You're talking about 3 groups of 3. You're talking about hit teams?
No, I'm talking about surveillance teams.
Ah, very good, okay.
Yeah, because they need to be on a 24/7 thing. So very often it's like they take turns, you know, 8-hour turn shifts like that. And so once these surveillance teams have checked out the victim, and it, like I say, with more or less all of these assassinations, I've tracked them down to the same group and the same people, so they've been used again and again in many, many variations all over the world. I'll get back to that in more detail.
Yeah, that's very, very important, yes.
So, okay, once you established the victim, his habits, bodyguards, and so on, once that is done, you, at the same time, you have prepared a patsy as well. This guy is often, they always use a lone crazy guy. And the reason why he's alone and why he's crazy is that by law, if more than one person is involved, you're talking about a conspiracy, and that they want to avoid at any cost, you know, because then they have all these problems with court cases and theories and so on. So they always try to blame it on one crazy guy. And the reason why he's supposed to be crazy is because he did it, the crime, for no apparent reason. He was crazy, that was it.
So they can obfuscate the true underlying motive, which is typically political, and almost always from a direction opposite of the political orientation of the individual they blame.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is why. And often this guy as well, he needs to look good in media. He needs to look suspicious. He needs to look weird. He needs to be maybe have a violent past or say weird things like that, because he needs to, you know, or nowadays they turn it around. Now they look like schoolboys, very nice little schoolboys that will freak people out, because then, once again, then they have to be afraid of anyone. It can be just anyone. Okay, so meanwhile, while they prepared this patsy and they prepared evidence and so on so that he can be framed right away as soon as the shot is fired, when we're getting close to the date when the actual hit is being done, they're also preparing for an investigation, their own investigation. And this investigation is on standby and is made by people of their own group or kind, you know, because these powers, political powers we're talking about, they've infiltrated on so many different layers that when it comes to these hits, they have people in the police force and murder investigations and so on very crucial key positions, so that when a thing like this is being done, as soon as the shots have been fired, they can move in their investigation and just kick out all normal, honest policemen, investigators, and so on. They're just pushed to the sides, and in moves this like a tank investigation. Their only mission is to point everywhere except towards the truth. They would point. They went that away, that away, that away, and everything that comes up with as real proof will be disregarded, and everything that is absolute lies but are pointing to the patsy, they will amplify that. Okay, so you got the investigation on standby, you got the patsy on standby, you got evidence prepared, and the surveillance team have done their job. Now comes the time when we're getting close to the exact hit, and very often, for some reason that I don't understand really, I've heard many different theories about this, but they're very they're very particular with dates and numbers and like ritual things, and the place where the hit is done is very often, it seems like it's an important part of it, but this part I do not know so much about.
You're talking about the art of assassination.
I'm talking about that these things are very often done on very specific dates.
Right, right. I'm saying this is part of the artistry. This is part of the signature. This is part of, you know, the distinctive pattern that a particular group will employ in order to, you know, give it, for those who know how to read the signs, the characteristics of an assassination by them. For example, in Dealey Plaza, I know a student well-versed in the military who believes that the assassination of JFK has all the distinctive marks of an operation by Edward Lansdale, who, of course, supervised assassinations all over the world, especially in Vietnam, on behalf of the CIA. So, you know, there's certain ways of doing these things. We can talk about all this in each case, because I think you really have studied this quite seriously, Ole, and I'm just absolutely delighted to have you here and to draw upon your expertise.
Oh, thank you, James. No, I spent, like, I think it's about 30 years of my life being really into this. So anyway, so now the time has come to pull in the real team of assassins. And the team of assassins are very often people pulled in from different countries, different groups, with no apparent connections. Very often these are connected to the Stay Behind Gladio network of the mercenaries or and so on, highly skilled assassin. They're pulled in, and the reasons why they're pulled in from different groups, different countries, and so on, is that if somebody starts looking into it, then it will look, it will point all over the place. Well, he was exiled Cuban. Well, he came from Argentina. Well, he was Swedish. Well, this guy was Norwegian. Well, that was English. You know, so it doesn't make any sense. And this is the whole point of why they do it like this.
Sure. So, to counteract any thoughts of it having been a conspiracy, they want to give separate identities to each of the participants, so it would be very difficult to imagine they could be collaborating together.
Exactly. And these teams are always, they always have local backup, you know, people, they're very often right-wing military men, ex-police, security people, that type of thing, fascist people, very disciplined, hard people. And they help the teams with weapons, logistics, housing, food, all of these things. And the team of assassins are very often moved around in different safe houses so that they're not in just one place, but they're moved around all, once again, so it's hard to track. And then when the time has come for the actual hit, the police on the local police are involved as well, or people who have joined that police. I don't know how to say it, but I mean, they come dressed as local policemen, but very often I think they come from other agencies on a higher level. So there's very often like a commando's bunker or central where everything is directed from, so that it's all coordinated from one place. And then as soon as the shots are fired,
we're talking about the command and control center.
Yeah. Then what they do, it's a very cowardly way of doing it. I mean, these people are extreme cowards, if you ask me, because they always want to make totally sure that the bodyguards are not there, that nothing can go wrong, and that the poor guy who's going to be put away, that he's all on his own with no defense whatsoever.
Well, and this is a great place for us to take our first break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest from Spain, Ole Damigard, talking about his research on assassinations, which included the study of the murder of Olof Palme, the Prime Minister of Sweden, in 1976. We'll be right back.
She's not a girl who misses much. Oh, yeah. with the touch of the velvet hand, like a lizard on a window pane. The man in the crowd with the multicolored mirrors on his hobnailed boots, lying with his eyes while his hands are busy working overtime. A soap impression of his wife, which he ate and donated to the National Trust. I need a fix, 'cause I'm going down, down to the pits that I left uptown. I need a fix, 'cause I'm going down. Mother Superior jumped the gun. 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 Mother Superior jumped the gun.
Even Bush admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it?
Who did it?
The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
He said, now look at that man, do you see what I see. Well, now I want that little chick. I want that little chick. Hey, man, say, want she for me?
Yeah.
Three cool chicks. Three cool chicks. They look like angels from up above. And three cool cats really fell in love. And three cool chicks made three cool sounds. Three cool cats. Three cool cats. Three cool cats. Three
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Ole Damegaard from Spain. Ole, you were talking about the cowardice of the attacks on the targets because they want to make absolutely sure that they are going to be successful and that none of them is going to be exposed to harm.
Yeah, exactly. Because one of the things they do, they very often have like triangular fire. They had that in Dealey Plaza. They had that in at Ambassador Hotel with Robert Kennedy. And they had that with Olof Palme as well, even though it's not officially the truth. But according to my research, that is what happened as well. It's because it's very, very important for them, absolutely crucial, that the victim dies. That is the main thing. The victim dies and that no one involved get caught. And the people in the hit team, the so-called mechanics, they are very aware that they don't have to fear the local police. They know that they're led away. And so one certain thing you will see after these things is, like, for instance, if you or I went down and took a rock and threw in the window of a Walmart center or something like that, within 2 minutes the police would be there to grab you and stop you and do whatever. But when it comes to like shooting the Prime Minister of Sweden, it took like 5 hours before the alarm went out, before anyone was alerted about what happened. And you can see that, I know like Fletcher Prouty once said that the way you can see there's a conspiracy is not often so much as what is done, but what is not done. And this is also a very clear pattern that when somebody, they need to make sure that everybody involved gets away. And as soon as they're out, it takes like an hour or so, and then they close the fence around the place and say, my God, we're so efficient, we're looking everywhere, and we're really going to make an incredible investigation here. But before that, they already made super sure that the people involved have left the place.
Ole, are you telling me that in the case of the assassination of Olof Palme, that it was a 5-year delay before the officials, the police and so forth, even were aware that he had been killed?
A 3-hour delay first for the first alert, and then it was 6 hours before it went out nationally.
How was that possible? How were they able to arrange that? Was he murdered in secret?
No, he was shot down. In one way he was murdered in secret. He was shot down in the streets of Stockholm, 11 o'clock at night, 11:30 almost. And it was a Friday evening, and absolutely no one heard about it. The alert that went out to the police cars were directed only to a few handpicked police cars, and these police cars were involved in the assassination.
Wow.
So no normal police had any idea what was going on. And then once it came out, the first rumors started about 1 o'clock in the morning, like almost 2 hours later. At that point, you know, normal policemen were just like, they came into the station saying, let me help. And the only thing they were set to do was like absolutely nothing, you know, just walking around in circles. Everything was on standby. And then, like I said, the honest murder investigators and policemen and so on that came forward, they were sort of alerted like 7 o'clock in the morning when they heard the news on the radio. That's when they found out, because nobody called them, nobody, you know, the whole thing is a massive farce if you look on, from the outside. But if you look at what actually happened, it's an absolute tragedy. And that is why also the book I've written about is called Coup d'etat in slow motion. Because it was a coup d'etat, people think it was just a lone crazy guy that shot the prime minister because he thought he was his drug dealer or mistook him for that. But it was actually a coup d'etat. The power that took over after that assassination is a power that is now connected to the same power elite as were behind the JFK assassination and all of these other ones that are... So...
Just for background, how many times was Olaf shot and from what directions?
He was only shot once.
Only shot once.
Officially, I think he was shot twice. But that is it gets very, very complicated. I was on Red Eyes Radio for Red Eyes Creations, and we had like 8 hours to go through this case because there's so much in it, so it's extremely.
All right, you started to talk about JFK and parallels there in the same group. Tell us more about that.
Well, one of the things that I found extremely interesting is Operation 40. Operation 40 was a group that was put together in the early 1960s by Eisenhower, and he put his helper, Richard Nixon, he was given this asked to put together a team of assassins that could be used anywhere in the world. The main aim for this group was to take out Fidel Castro at that time. And the guy they put in charge to finance the group, to collect finances for this, was George Bush Sr. So Nixon and Bush Sr. was very deeply involved in creating this group of assassins. And the reason why they was called Operation 40 was that the first group put together had 40 members. In this group, you will find names that to this very day, are very central in many of the big assassinations worldwide. So this group for me is extremely important. The group was one of the leaders was David Attlee Phillips, also called as Morris Bishop, which is very central in the JFK assassination. He also had Ted Shackley and E. Howard Hunt. These three people were in the top, sort of. And underneath them, there were mostly exiled Cubans they put together. There were people like David Morales, there were people like Felipe Vidal Santiago, and so on, many names that we can come back to. But what happened was that once they started having problems with Kennedy instead, because in my opinion, Kennedy was the last real president that was elected, even though the mob was involved in that election as well. But he was the last real president. All the presidents after him has been part of the group that took over by this coup d'etat that took place in Dallas 1963. That is my conviction.
Repeat what you just said.
What I said was that I believe that JFK was the last president that was really elected by the people.
Yeah.
From him and onwards, it's been people that were part of the assassination. They were loyal to the cause, and therefore they went up in the ranks, and they have been put as a front figure for this machine.
Yes, we had a whole succession of presidents who would never have occupied the office but for the death of JFK, including most obviously Lyndon Johnson, but also Richard Nixon, but also Gerald Ford, but also George Herbert Walker Bush, and eventually, of course, W, who would never have been taken seriously but for his father having served in that capacity. It seems to me Jimmy Carter and Bill Clinton and even Ronald Reagan were exceptions, but I would be fascinated by any light you would shed on their on how they could have assumed the presidency under these conditions.
Now, what a president is nowadays is just a front figure, a nice face to look at, somebody who looks decent and honest and say things that you want to hear, like freedom or change or justice or anything like that. But it's absolute crap what they're saying. You have to look at their actions, not their words. Because
I think the best illustration of this, Ole, is Barack Hussein Obama. I think he is absolutely stunning in this regard. And I must confess, as all of our regular listeners know, that I was completely taken in by him as a candidate when he was running against John McCain. I mean, I thought he was the perfect person, given his background in the law at Harvard and Chicago, to place the country back on a firm constitutional footing. How wrong I was.
No, but I loved Barack Obama. I love listening to him, and I mean, he's perfect for the part. But he's just a disguise of the same massive machine that has just been moving on and changed faces. It's exactly the same machine behind Reagan as Barack Obama, as the boy George Bush, Barack Obama, same machine, different face. And Barack Obama, I mean, I think he's almost the worst of them all, because he's so nice. He's got such a beautiful voice. They put this guy together from day one. As far as I know, his identity doesn't even, he's a created identity.
I have a friend who's very, very strong on what you're saying here, and I believe there's a lot to it. He does appear to have been born in Kenya. He did have citizenship in Indonesia. When he came to the United States, he apparently was receiving fellowships and forms of support only available to foreign students. Hence, the very first act he took as president was to seal all of his educational records. If you stop and think about it, here you have a president of the United States who is concealing from the public the history of his education. I mean, on the face of it, that's completely absurd.
I mean, his real name is Barry Soetoro, as far as I know. He's got his social security number is totally false. It's from a dead person in the 1890s. And it seems, as far as I've been able to figure out, that this was he and many, it's like these people, this power elite group that we might go into more details about later, but they almost have like a stable, like a chessboard of people, so that in different situations they can move forward and say, okay, in this situation we need this type of person, in this situation we need that type of person, and so they can play tricks with our minds. And I think that is exactly what they did with Barack Obama, where we're back to the problem, reaction, solution. First you had George Bush Sr., which is a main player in this elite group. Main, very, very high up.
Yes.
His son, an absolute joke. He's only there as a face, a front figure, so that his dad and the rest of this group can move forward without
especially
being stopped.
Especially Dick Cheney really running the shop.
Yeah, Dick Cheney is one of the Anyway.
I've described him as one of the most malignant forces to ever assume high office in the United States.
And the only reason they assume high office is because they help each other to that level. Because if you're not part of that group, you will never get up there. So the more loyal you are to their cause, the higher up you get. And it's just super rotten. I mean, we're talking about, I cannot express how criminal these people are. It's just on a level unheard of, in my opinion.
Yes.
I mean, Adolf Hitler is almost like a kindergarten child compared to
their ops when you properly understand them.
Yeah, I feel that. But with Barack
Hitler was
Obama,
all above board. You knew everything he was doing, saying, and the actions he was taking. But with these people, it's all subtle and concealed and covert and very, very nasty.
But also, Hitler was financed by the same group as well. The finances went partly through Prescott Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush's dad, and was financed. And because this elite group, they have been active for generations, and they thrive on death and destruction and war. And this is why peace, and anyone who supports peace and stands up and that people will listen to, becomes an enemy to this group. And that is why people like Martin Luther King, John Lennon, Gandhi, JFK, and so on, were taken out, because they need to continue on this death and destruction road. Anyway, with Barack Obama, I think what they did was that they created a problem with Boy George.
Yeah, that's fine.
They created a problem. They just made him worse and worse and worse and worse, so that in the end people were just like almost screaming, we can't take anymore. And at that point, in on stage comes this Messias, you know, boosted by the media, controlled by them.
You know, tall, handsome, articulate, and black.
Yeah, and also what they used, as far as I've understood, is that, do you remember the series 24?
Yes.
Yeah, with Kiefer Sutherland and so on. That was the first series ever with a black president.
Yes.
And the first series, this president was just wonderful. I mean, he was so...
President David Palmer.
Exactly.
Olaf, by coincidence, over the last month, my wife and I have watched the entire 8 seasons of 24.
Okay. But then you can see also that I'm talking about the first series to start with, that the president there, he was standing, all he stood for was, you know,
honest, open integrity. Yes, justice, truth.
Wonderful. And at that time, a black president was totally unheard of. But I believe that this is one of the way they prepared us for Barack Obama.
Olaf, there are multiple dimensions here, because it also created a kind of background of paranoia about terrorists being located at every level of the government with all kinds of biological, nuclear, and other weapons, that there was an immense terrorist threat. And second of all, that torture was an effective instrument to extract information, provide actionable intelligence, which every expert realizes is completely false, and which even Kiefer Sutherland, who of course plays Jack Bauer, has acknowledged to the public. But it set it up for Bush and Cheney, you know, to employ torture on Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, for example, whom they claim to have been the mastermind of 9/11. All rubbish, of course. He was waterboarded at least 180 times, I think, on even one day, and he confessed to over 30 crimes, including terrorist acts, including some that occurred when he was a child, and others that occurred after he'd been taken into custody.
But if you rewind the tape a bit, this first season, there was no torture. He was such a beautiful person. He was like a new Martin Luther King type of president. And the torture came slowly in the second and third series, as far as I know. You know, so they slowly integrated that suddenly the president, who was such a beautiful person, but he had to, under these circumstances, torture so that you slowly got used to this thing. And then in the end, I mean, they were beating people right, left, and center and whipping them, and I don't know, awful stuff.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, the whole series was very expensive. A lot of money was put into it, and I'm convinced now that there were underlying themes that were of a propagandistic character that the powerful forces wanted to convey to the American people to create, you know, to pave the way for further employment of torture and terrorism as political instruments.
Yeah. And then in on stage comes Barack Obama. And even, I mean, no one had heard of this guy. Absolutely, as far as I know, absolutely no one. He came from absolute nowhere, and he was named the best president ever before he was even elected.
And given a Nobel Peace Prize before he'd ever earned it, and now I think it ought properly to be taken away from him and given to others like Bradley Manning or perhaps Edward Snowden.
It's getting to ridiculous proportions, like when Henry Kissinger gets the Nobel Prize, Peace Prize, and Barack Obama.
Kissinger's been responsible for the deaths of millions of people around the world, millions.
That's what I'm saying. Hitler is no one in this group, you know. It's like, and then, once again, Barack Obama, he looks very nice, and he speaks very softly and nice, but if you see what he stands for and what is going on while he's sitting in the White House, it's absolutely awful. I feel very, very sad to see what's going on, especially in your country at the moment, how it's just being totally raped at the...
Oh, it's terrible. Oh, it's absolutely god-awful. And I'm afraid the greatest calamities are yet to come.
I hope you're wrong. I really, really hope you're wrong. But I can totally understand your fears, I must say, because this is getting so out of hand. But...
Ole, I think this might be a perfect place for us to take our second break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Ole Damegaard, who's talking about assassinations around the world, including Olof Palme, JFK, Bobby, and a host of others, where he's been studying the patterns that are exemplified thereby, and the fact that many of the same individuals are being used for these purposes. We'll be right back.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Veer Radio is listener-supported. We need your donations to pay for live internet streaming radio, our toll-free call-in number, and our website, free MP3 archive links, and interactive forums. RevereRadioNetwork.com and click on the Make a Donation button.
On the 50th observance of the death of JFK, Santa Barbara is the place to be. Dallas will be locked down tighter than a drum. The cutting edge of JFK research will be in Santa Barbara. This is an event you don't want to miss. Phil Nelson on the pivotal role of LBJ. John Hankey on George Herbert Walker Bush and his hit team. Peter Janney on Mary Meyer and her diary. Ralph Sinque on The Man in the Doorway. Larry Rivera on Buell Wesley Fraser. Judith Baker on Lee and Me in New Orleans. Jim Fetzer on the assassination of America. This is an event you don't want to miss. Go to JFK 50th, the keys to understanding his assassination on Veterans Today for more. Be there.
Bésame, mucho. Each time I bring you kiss, I hear music divine. So, bésame, bésame, mucho. I'll love you forever, say that you'll always be mine. Here's one, if you should leave me. Then each little dream would take wings, and my life would be through. Oh, bésame, bésame mucho. Oh, love me forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, this joy is something new. My arms are holding you. Never knew this thrill before. Holding you close to me, whispering, it's you I adore. Yes, so dearest one, if you should leave me, then each little dream would take wings, and my life would be through. Oh, so bésame, bésame mucho. Yeah, love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Joy is something new. My arms are holding you. Never knew this, the thrill before. Who ever thought I'd be holding you close to me, whispering, it's you I adore. Oh, so dearest one, if you should leave me, then each little dream will take wings, and my life will be through. Oh, so bésame, bésame mucho. And I'll love you forever, make all my dreams come true. Oh, love you forever, make all my dreams come true.
Ooh, love you forever. Before we begin the third segment, I want to mention that Ole has a website at lightonconspiracies.com, as in shed light on. Lightonconspiracies.com. One word, lightonconspiracies.com. Check it out. This guy has been doing his homework. I'm fascinated by what he has to say. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Ole Damigard. Please do continue, Ole, about, you know, your drawing out connections with JFK and how many of the people from Operation 40 were involved here, how George H.W. Bush and Richard Nixon were deeply involved in all of this. And, of course, you may or may not know that when Nixon was a congressman and very active in the House Un-American Activities Committee, that Jack Rubenstein, later known as Jack Ruby, was one of the investigators who worked for him.
Mm. This is the thing. When you look into these things, it's just like jaw-dropping sometimes, isn't it? Anyway, if we go back to Dealey Plaza, I know there's so many different theories about the number of shooters and so on. I've got my own theory. I'd be happy to share if you're interested.
Yeah, oh, absolutely do. Yes, yes, yes.
I believe that there was a multiple shooters in at least 3 or 4 teams that spread out. And if I can identify them, I would be very happy to.
Yes. I think you're on the right track. I have myself identified shooters at 6 different locations, even by name, so I'm fascinated to hear what you have to say.
Okay, by name, I would say in the Doltex building. Once again, if we go back to the way of when they put together a hit team, they put it together with people from the different groups involved, and one of the reasons why they do that is so that everybody's got their fingers dipped in blood.
Yes, exactly.
So that no group can point at the other ones. Everybody
without incriminating themselves.
Exactly. That's how they did with Julius Caesar, and that is how they've been doing it again.
You're exactly right.
So if we start with the Dolcex building, in that building, there was the shooter was Chucky Nicoletti. He was on the second floor underneath the fire escape. He was the shooter, and he had a spotter. But very often, or if not always, you got one shooter and one spotter, at least. So Chucky Nicoletti, he was from the Chicago mob, a hit guy. And then his spotter was Nestor Izquierdo. He was not from Operation 40, but a military guy who was very close to Operation 40.
This is Tony. Very interesting, because I have Nestor Tony Escudero as the shooter, where George H.W. Bush may even have been right there in the room of the broom closet of the uranium mining company that was a CIA asset from which three shots appear to have been fired.
No, George was there as well.
That's
exactly.
What I'm saying. Yeah,
exactly. So we totally agree that the shooter, I truly believe, was Chucky Nicoletti from different sources. Anyway, George Bush.
But you also have Nestor Tony Escudero there, and my sources identify him as having been the shooter. And, you know, they put up a monument to him, a statue in Little Havana, in Freedom Park in Little Havana. I mean, there are two statues there. Ole, one is to Jose Marte, who freed Cuba from Spanish domination, and the other to Tony Escudero. I mean, you know. And if you ask somebody there, you know, why is this statue here? They might say, well, because he took care of business.
Oh, but I tell you, if you go around in Florida, you will find more statues of people involved in Operation 40, and so they see themselves as freedom fighters.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
I would call them real terrorists. They
yes.
see themselves as freedom fighters.
Yes.
Anyway, but George Bush seems to have been in that building as well, just like you say. And when they seem to have managed to get him out of the building without nobody really noticing.
No, actually, he was arrested coming out of the building, and they had to do some fancy footwork to emancipate him. We have a new article about it entitled, Did George H.W. Bush Supervise a JFK Hit Team on Veterans Today? The principal author being Richard Hook. It's a fascinating article that you might enjoy yourself, Ole, but I love what you've done. Please do continue.
Yeah, exactly. How they got away or confused him so he got away was that they said they arrested him, but instead afterwards it was said that they had arrested this Hale Brading.
Yes,
Jim Brading, exactly, who was also a mob figure, but they say that was the guy, but actually it was George that they took.
Right, and very good. You've done
George,
your homework, that's clear.
George can also be seen later, after the assassination, on some photos, at least one way standing to the left of the entrance.
Yes. I thought when I first discovered that in Jesse Curry's JFK assassination file that I'd been the first to identify him as that figure, but I now believe that others anticipated were there ahead of me. We also have a photograph, you know, of Edward Lansdale walking past the three tramps, and a third photograph of Lansdale waiting to speak to George Herbert Walker Bush.
Yeah, and that Lansdale has been identified by Fletcher Froutian, among others. So
Victor Krulak.
And they used to work together, so that's a dead-on identification. Anyway, then up in the school book depository, according to what I've been able to figure out, Eladio Del Valle was one of the shooters in the so-called Oswald window. And then Arminio Diaz Garcia, who was another member of the... Both of these two guys were a member of the Operation 40. He was an exiled Cuban, a black guy. As far as I know, he was the guy who later drove this green Ruth Payne
green car, right.
Exactly, and picked up Oswald I can't remember who else was in it. Anyway,
it may have been somebody who looked like Oswald, but continue. I'm fascinated by what you're saying. Even if we disagree, this is really remarkable. Go for it.
Sure what happened that day, were the people there, because most of them are dead, so it's like this, there are all these theories. I can just say this is my theory.
Yeah, of course.
On the left-hand side, The shooter was Richard Kane from the Chicago mob again.
And where was Richard located?
In the left window, in the window to the far left.
Go ahead.
Eladio Del Valle was in the right-hand window with Herminio Diaz Garcia. Herminio Garcia Diaz. I always confuse these two. And these are the two people with a bald spot that the people in the from the prison sees, and also from the street level, they notice this bald spot on both of them. Anyway, then if we go down on the grassy knoll, there's one white car parked where there's a shooter standing next to it. And I believe that guy is either Roscoe White or Frank Fiorini or Frank Sturgis. I'm not sure which one.
I believe both Roscoe, who I identify as Badge Man, and Frank Sturgis, who I believe was firing from the above-ground sewer opening halfway between the roadway and the top of the triple underpass, were two of the shooters, yes.
In that case, because I've got Sturgis or Roscoe White under in this manhole, so I don't know which one is where. So let's say that Roscoe White was the guy near the car. Then the next one is Badgeman, which I think is Lucien Sarti, who came from the Marseille mob and was brought in by connection through the Chicago mob. He was brought in by that. And he very often appeared in police uniforms. This day he had the Dallas black police uniform on. Next to him there's a railroad worker, which I believe is the same railroad worker as the witness Ed Hoffman saw, where he saw the guy walk away the
disassemble his weapon.
Disassemble the weapon and
put it into a toolbox, and then the construction worker walked away with it.
Exactly. Then you got behind the tree, you got James Files, and Sturgis from the manhole were the two that gave that shot almost identical, that made the headshot, the final headshots. It came from behind as well, I think. But these are the main shooters. Then you got Bernard Baker. He was the guy, the Secret Service guy who held up a Secret Service ID when people came rushing up the grassy knoll looking for the shooter. He was the one stopping it. And this Bernard Baker was also part of Operation 40. James Files is a very interesting figure because he will be very central in many of the other things I'm going to talk about. Bernard Baker and Frank Sturgis and other members of Operation 40 were later part of the Watergate burglary. They were part of the Watergate burglars.
Yes.
And the reason why they did this break-in was because Nixon was getting really paranoid that his part in the JFK assassination would be discovered. So they were in there one of the reasons they were in there was to get rid of evidence. Well, this, let me see if I got, yeah, then we have the umbrella man, the man with the umbrella. The reason why he was standing there on a sunny November day with a black umbrella was to, according to my opinion, to mark when everybody shoots from different direction. They couldn't have people shooting all over the place. Everybody needed to shoot at the same place so that they could blame it on one patsy. So they had this guy to mark the point where the shooting should take place. That is why he stood with the umbrella. And his name was Roy Hargraves. He was also a mercenary.
That's interesting. I agree it was Roy Hargraves.
And he was not part of Operation 40, but these COINTREL and Operation 40 and these, they were very close together, these groups. And the guy in front of him is very interesting as well. There's a black or a dark standing waving just in front of him,
shaking his fist actually.
In my opinion, this guy, his name was Felipe Vidal Santiago.
We agree.
And this guy is very interesting as well. He was part of also very close to Operation 40. And this guy later appears under another name. He used the name Charles Morgan. And in 1986, he was in Stockholm trying to hire people to shoot the Swedish Prime Minister.
Really? Under this. Really?
Yeah. Yeah.
Mustn't he have been very conspicuous in Sweden? I mean, here, you know, how often is there a Cuban in Sweden?
What can I say?
He had to have stood out like a sore thumb.
Well, what can I say? It was still him. I mean, he...
I'm not denying that. I'm just saying he must have been very conspicuous, his presence.
But he's not that dark in his skin. And I mean, there's lots of foreigners in Sweden as well, so...
All right.
But anyway, let me see here.
Do you have other shooters in front of the limousine?
No, not as far as I know.
Are you aware that one of the shots that hit JFK in the throat passed through the windshield?
I've heard that one, but I've never been able to figure out who was standing where. Is that something you can tell me?
Yeah. Appears to have been fired from an above-ground sewer opening halfway between the roadway and the top of the triple underpass on the south side.
Aren't we talking about this manhole thing under the lid?
No, we're not talking about the sewer level opening. David Mandick and I got down there. David actually got inside. The ballistics are wrong. No shot appears to have been fired from there.
Okay. So where was the shot fired from?
Which one?
The one you're talking about, from the front.
The first hit, I mean, JFK was hit four times. The first hit was to his back, fired from the top of the county record building. I have him identified as a Dallas deputy sheriff by the name of Harry Weatherford. The second shot was then from that above-ground sewer opening on the south side of the triple underpass, halfway between the roadway and the top of the underpass, which I believe was fired by an Air Force expert by the name of Jack Lawrence. That went through a windshield, hit Jack in the throat. Hit his skeleton in fragmented part, went down into his right lung, part upward, and ruptured this tough membrane that covers the cerebellum known as the tentorium, which was the analysis of Bob Livingston, MD, a world authority on the human brain, who was also an expert on wound ballistics.
This Jack Lawrence is interesting as well because he pops up at different areas as well.
Very good. Yeah, continue. I'm just fascinated by everything you're saying. This is
okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter that we may disagree on some of these identifications. We're so much in the same ballpark.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't. For me, it's not disagreeing. For me, it's learning from, you know, like, because like, it's such a massive, like I said, mystery on top of a labyrinth in an enigma. It's not easy.
Yes.
And the people involved didn't even know. They only knew their part.
Right, you know, that's right. Highly compartmentalized and classified, as was 9/11.
Yeah. And this is that is why Dallas is very interesting to study, because it's like a showcase of how it's done. Also with in Dealey Plaza that day, it was almost like a rock concert, you know, like if Michael Jackson would come to Stockholm, then all the Swedish rock stars would come and see the concert and so on.
Yes, the third of the three tramps, often misidentified as E. Howard Hunt, was also actually Chauncey Marvin Holt. Yeah,
exactly.
who prepared 15 sets of forged Secret Service credentials for use in and around Dealey Plaza. And when he initially arrived there, he was told to leave them in a red pickup truck that was parked behind the picket fence, which, of course, was a parking lot used by the Dallas police. But it wasn't there, so he wandered around Dealey Plaza, and he told me he saw more bad guys, mercenaries, and hitmen than you'd find at a Soldiers of Fortune convention.
Exactly. So when you go around and check out Dealey Plaza that day, there were all of these people like David Morales, who was David Morales was way up in Operation 40.
David Sanchez Morales, yes, exactly. Yeah. Go ahead.
He was also at the Ambassador Hotel when Robert Kennedy was shot.
Yes.
At that time, he was high up, high-ranking officer. He was also the guy who helped Felix Rodriguez, who was also part of Operation 40, to track down Che Guevara in Bolivia. And David Morales, he was also called the Indio. He was the one that actually shot Che Guevara on the orders of Felix Rodriguez.
You know, he actually cut off his head and then kicked it, you know, 20 or 30 yards away so there wouldn't be any myths about whether Che had survived.
Charming guys.
Did you know that E. Howard Hunt, you know, when he gave his last confessions to his son, St. John, whom I have met, identified the chain of command as Lyndon Johnson, Cord Meyer, David Attlee Phillips, William Harvey, then David Sanchez.
Sanchez
Morales.
Another very not nice figure in Dealey Plaza that day was Orlando Bosch.
Yes.
Which he's central in so many terror acts. I mean, he was put away for, I think, almost 200 acts of bombs and terror acts all over the place. And then pardoned, of course, by George Bush Sr.
He may have had to do with the assassination of the reporter in Washington, D.C., Raymond Letellier. That was
No, Orlando Letellier. He was the one that prepared the bomb for
that. Prepared the bomb. Yeah, okay.
And this is where it becomes interesting again, because David Atlee Phillips, who was way up in the CIA, he was the controller of Lee Harvey Oswald. He was also the controller of James Files, and he was also the controller of a man called Michael Vernon Townley, who he was not part of the Operation 40 at that stage, but he later becomes very central in many, many, many terror acts all over the world.
Well, of course, he was in charge of CIA for Western Hemisphere, and there's a photograph at a press conference in after the assassination where you can see him right in the front row. I'm convinced he's right there staring at, I believe it was Lee Oswald.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. But this is the thing with these guys. They know that they can get away with anything, so they're not shy, you know. They're just...
Yes.
Why would they be there? Why would they show themselves at all? Why wouldn't they be 300 kilometers away? But one thing that is important to know is that why didn't they just put a pill in Kennedy's coffee if they want to get rid of him? Why it would be so easy? Why didn't they just do the same with Olof Palme, or create a heart attack or something like that? The reason, I believe, is that they want to show the people in the dark corridors of power that we can get anyone, anywhere, at any time.
Well, so I think it's an anti-conspiracy theory move, because if Jack hadn't been taken out in a public place in front of hundreds of spectators, everyone would have inferred that it was a conspiracy. If he died in the dead of night in the White House, no one would have believed it had been a lone demented gunman.
Well, then again, how many heart attacks and cancers and I don't know how. I mean, there's so many people who have died in strange ways.
Yes. And so many of them were on CIA hit lists.
Yeah, so I believe that one of the reasons they've done it in front of cameras and open daylight and so on is to create fear. And that is also, after these conspiracies, you there's this almost like a conspiracy of silence that follows. You know, like in Sweden, no one says anything officially except for the official story. To this day, doesn't matter how much evidence comes forward, just like with JFK, it's the standard story, the Patsy did it. That the only question is, did he do it or didn't he? It's not a matter of that there was a massive conspiracy behind the whole thing with loads and tons of evidence that is out there. But instead, the people in power, so-called power, it's just quiet. Nobody wants to know. Nobody wants to look into it. Nobody wants to stand up and say anything. There are no museums about Olof Palme in Sweden. There are no statues. There's no nothing. It's just like, let's just forget it, you know. That said, I don't think that very many people are aware of how it happened or who actually did it. But they're very aware of the power behind and what that power can do to them or their careers and so on, because they're shark food, they're in shark water. So anyway, one thing with Dealey Plaza that I think, it's just a theory, but I believe that the shooters on the sixth floor, the way they got out of the building without anyone noticing was that the elevator was blocked that day.
Yes.
And I think these guys went down the elevator shaft on ropes and then got out at the bottom floor. That is how I think they got out.
You know, my analysis has suggested that no shots were actually fired from that sixth floor assassin's window, but that the three shots that were fired from the Dow Techs were the only ones done with an unsilenced Mannlicher Carcano, and acoustically it created the impression that they might have been fired from that sixth floor window, where of course Oswald was actually in the doorway when you get into the analysis of the Alchin's photograph. It's just astounding how blatant they are about all of this.
Yeah. No, it makes perfect sense what you say. So, where to go from here?
Yeah, you're talking about the use of the same groups, you know, and you mentioned Jack Lawrence, and you also mentioned Bernard Baker and Orlando Bosch. Those might be three people to pick up on.
Yeah, there's one. Do you know when John Lennon was shot?
Yes.
John Lennon was not just anyone. He was a peacemaker, and that, once again, just like Lady Diana and Martin Luther King and so on, this military-industrial complex, they do not want people promoting peace.
Yes.
And especially when people listen to them, when it comes to the millions, then they become a big threat. And John Lennon was just at a point where he was doing his comeback after many years. He was just recording his new album together with Yoko Ono. And that evening when they came to the Dakota building, the limo stopped and you had Mark Chapman was standing there waiting.
Mark Chapman, yes.
Yeah, Mark Chapman is, in my opinion, one of these mind-controlled patsies, just like Sirhan Sirhan.
Yes.
Do you know that? And the same in the Oslo shooting. It's a guy that is... He's just standing there waiting. One of the typical patterns with these guys is that after it happens, they just stand there waiting to be caught. They don't say anything. They're just standing like almost like zombies. And then when they're asked about the crime, they repeat the same story almost like a taped loop that just goes around and around.
You know,
and
this
around.
Absurd case in the UK where this, British soldier is allegedly beheaded, it all appears to be a complete farce. But the guys who did it just waited around for 30 minutes before the police showed up, the bobbies.
Oh, this is my favorite. I love that one. It's so sloppy. It's so sloppy. It's so low budget. It's such a crap performance.
Another is, of course, the Boston bombing. That is so slovenly, again. And the alternative media had actually cracked the case by the evening of the day it occurred, that Monday.
I know, that is another favorite. But I'll get back to the beheading if you want, because that one I absolutely love. But if we go back to John Lennon, then what happened?
Yeah, by the way, I have had guests on John Lennon, including Claire Kuhn, and on this beheading, Nick Kohlerstrom. I mean, these are fascinating cases, and I'm very eager to have your take on all of them.
Okay. We'll take them one by one. Okay, so with John Lennon, Yoko went in first, and then John came 5-6 meters after her. And the thing was that Mark Chapman was standing on the right, but John Lennon was shot, I think it was 4 times, from the left. So the question is, who was standing at the left? And the man that was standing there, he's referred to as the doorman in the beginning. You can hear one of the first witnesses, a woman, she says, Lennon was arguing with the doorman. They were arguing, that's what she says. And that doorman, he was named right in the beginning, and then he totally disappears in media, which is why when things like this happen, you need to be so on the case right away, because what comes out in the beginning is maybe the truth, but it will disappear within 24 hours.
Typically a whole lot closer to the truth than when they refine the story to make it more marketable to the public.
Totally, totally. So you need to be on your marks and go boom when it happens. Anyway, so this man, his name is Jose Perdomo, and he was in his 70s, I think, when this happened, a nice-looking gentleman. But when you track this guy down, it turns out that Jose Perdomo was actually the officer in command for 10 years of Operation 40. So is that a coincidence?
Wow.
That, for me,
you know,
that
I've been aware of Perdomo's role here, but not that he was allied or a part of Operation 40. That's very important and incriminating.
Very, I think so, too. Then you got...
You know, Clear Channel, as I recall, after 9/11, banned like 100 different songs from being played on the radio stations they controlled, which is like 1,200 radio stations across the country. And in those 100 songs they banned, there were all these peace songs, you know, Peter, Paul, and Mary, and John Lennon, and the Beatles, and all that, you know, and Imagine. I mean, it's just stunning the power of these entities to control what, you know, and music has such a powerful emotional effect. It was clearly a deliberate psyop to exclude those songs from even being played on their 1,200 stations.
Well, it just shows you the power of music and the power of lyrics and the power of artists. And this is why when there is a takeover, very often the first group they go for are like singers, poets, writers.
Yes.
And, you know, that create a free mind.
Yeah, the intelligentsia. Yeah, those who are able to dissect and analyze what's going on.
Yeah.
And those who are able to convey views about it that may be contrary to the official accounts.
Do you know the meaning of the word paranoid?
Yes.
The real meaning of the word paranoid, as far as I've been explained, is that it's somebody with the ability to connect events that no one else can see are connected. So in that perspective, I'm happy to say that I'm paranoid.
Well, and as am I. I mean, I regard that as synthetic reasoning. The vice chancellor who hired me at the University of Minnesota Duluth came to hear one of my talks about JFK. And afterwards, he told me he'd never encountered anyone who had the synthetic reasoning ability to connect all of these disparate, seemingly disparate parts.
There you go. So, another one that was taken out was Bob Marley. I don't know if you know that he was murdered as well.
Yeah, there was a poison needle in a boot. He was given this new pair of boots, and when he put it on, he was pricked with a poison needle. It's really a nasty case.
But do you know who gave him the boots?
Was it Bush, was it?
No. It was Peter Colby, the son of William Colby, the former CIA chief of CIA.
It was William Colby who told us that the CIA owns everyone of significance in the major media.
Yeah. This William Colby is very central as well. He was part of building up the whole Gladio network in Europe and Sweden. And
really?
And, he was at the Swedish embassy when they started building it up, together with Olof Palme. He was, and also... Like Gladio is very central in the assassination of Palme. He was actually shot right outside the very building where the Stay Behind headquarters used to be. And there's a network of tunnels just below the subway level. There's about 618 kilometers of tunnels underneath Stockholm, and that is where some of them got away.
And, of course, there's a sewer network beneath Dealey Plaza, which is how some of the shooters got away there. I mean, Jack Lawrence, who'd gone to work for that automobile dealership just days before, shows up there after the assassination, all muddy and nauseated, you know. But it's really stunning stuff, but he appears to have made his escape through the sewer system. Ole, we got to take our final break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest, Ole Damigard from Spain, who is giving us an analysis based upon his research of assassinations for the last several decades. Fascinating stuff. We'll be right back. Like a rolling stone. Like a rolling stone. Like the FBI.
Stem cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin.
at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render unto Darwin.
That Jim Fetzer concluding my conversation with Ole Damigard from Spain, who is giving us the benefit of his analysis of assassinations. Ole, I wish we had more time than we do now. I want to have you back. Please do continue and give us as much as you can in the next 25 minutes.
Okay. Another member in Operation 40, his name was Porter Goss, and he was part of the team of assassins, but he in his later years became all the way up director of the CIA, and he was then he withdrew. I can't remember why he resigned. There was some reason, and after that he was part of creating Homeland Security and also one of these other awful things that is going on at the moment. It's these people, they just pop up all over the place. Also, another one was Barry Seal. He was a pilot, and Barry Seal was part in Dealey Plaza, as far as I know, flying people in there. But he was also very central in the whole Iran-Contras affair.
Yes.
The whole scandal, where he was one of the main pilots. And what they did was there was an exchange of weapons and drugs. So they flew weapons that was taken from the National Guard, under the surveillance of Colin Powell, as far as I know, where they got these weapons and got rid of the serial numbers, then flew them out down to Nicaragua and other countries, and with the same planes, returning planes, they filled them with cocaine and other hard drugs. And one of the airports that were used in the beginning was in Arkansas, in a small little town called Mena. And at that time, the governor of that state was Bill Clinton.
Yes.
At that time, he was totally unknown. And he and Hillary, when you start looking into their background, not a pretty thing. Very criminal people.
And there's another charismatic, articulate, handsome guy, Bill Clinton. I mean, you know, if there's anyone over whom Americans have swooned, you know, as political figures of recent times, I mean, since Jack Kennedy, it's been Ronald Reagan, but then Bill Clinton, and now Barry Sotero.
Yeah, but it's sort of, they choose actors, you know, they chose Ronald Reagan for a reason. It's not because he was clever. It's like, he looks good, he acts
yes.
nice, he combs his hair nicely,
yes.
you know, like he says things that, ooh, that sounds good. But it's
and with George Herbert Walker Bush as his vice president, he could be taking care of business while Reagan's out making speeches.
Exactly. Just keep the front up and we'll take care of business in the back. Do you know there's one family in Sweden that is very, very powerful? And they're called the Wallenberg family. And they have a motto, and how shall I translate it? It's Italian, but it means ruling without being visible. Yes. And I think that motto is very, it says a lot, you know, because yes. you hardly hear about these people. But at the same, it's like the Rothschild, Evelyn Rothschild. I mean, who knows about this guy? Who knows that he's one of the, if not, well, one of the most wealthy people on the globe? And very few people have any idea how much he's involved in. Anyway, so with this, also I must say that Olof Palme himself was part of a group called the Committee of 300, which is a very, very, very special group. They say that one of the reasons that they created this group was to centralize the banking system, to make all banks become one global central bank. But when you look at the members in this group, you got so many, like, way up there people, like Rockefeller and Microsoft, the Microsoft guy. You got royalties, you got people like Olof Palme, you got prime ministers and all of these. It's a bit like the Bilderberg group, but many of them are part of the same, of both. But did you know that one of the members, the current members in the Committee of 300, was actually one of the assassins of Olof Palme as well?
Really?
Which I find, like, once again, mind-boggling. But there again, you have somebody who's loyal to the cause and do what he, you know, like, is loyal. He goes up in the ranks. And this guy is an Italian guy. He's still around, an Italian terror expert. He was called the King of Terror. His name is Stefano Della Chiaia, and he was a close friend and associate with the guy we spoke about before, Michael Vernon Townley, who is Michael Vernon Townley. His dad used to work for the CIA, and then when he grew up, they moved to, I think it was Chile. And in Chile, he became very involved in the whole movement. And also he got involved with the CIA. And later he was used in many different major assassinations, like the Orlando Letier and the Washington bombing. I mean, that was the biggest so-called terror threat on American ground before 9/11.
Yes.
So it was a very, very big thing, a car bomb that blew up Orlando Letier. But he was also deeply involved in Operation Condor in South America, where they tracked down people that were against the Chile junta. They killed them right, left, and center all over the globe. They tracked them. He was also the killer of
a series of assassinations and bombings in prominent areas of the United States, such as Washington, was also a part of Operation Northwoods, which, of course, you know, Lyman Lemnitzer proposed to JFK, who had Maxwell Taylor vetting it, and he rejected all of these proposals.
But these things go hand in hand. They totally go hand in hand. Another guy that was part of this thing in Washington, this car bomb, was James Files, one of the shooters in Dealey Plaza. He was there as well. You had Orlando Bosch, who delivered the bombs. You had, the Novo brothers were there as well, Novo Sampo.
Are we talking about Washington, D.C.?
Yeah.
Fascinating. Really? These individuals were involved in that too?
Yeah. And also, you got... They bombed an airliner. I think there was 276 people or something like that that died, where Orlando Bosch was the one delivering the bomb. But according to my what I've been able to find out, James Files was part of that operation as well.
Really?
And also, one of the things that I find really interesting is that Michael Vernon Townley worked under the control of David Attlee Phillips. He was his controller. And while he was in Chile, they were part of overthrowing Salvador Allende. They were there when at the actual whole thing. And afterwards, they were training the local troops in torture and all of these awful things.
The United States is very good at overthrowing democratic governments. I mean, Allende was a Marxist, but he was democratically elected by the Chilean people, just as they overthrew the democratic government of Iran. You know, that was one of the first destabilization programs where Kermit Roosevelt was deeply involved in that.
Yeah. Now, when you look at your history, it's not a very pretty sight.
No, and we've done this over and over again around the world. Yeah. It's completely disgusting. Vietnam, of course, is another striking case where we actually had the leaders of the government assassinated, though that was contrary to JFK's desire.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. But this Michael Vernon Townley, he's like I said, he was under the control of David Attlee Phillips. And one of the things he was asked to do was put together two groups that would help to track down these left sympathizers. And in one of these groups, there were two members. One was, his name was Roberto Tieme. He was an Argentinian assassin. And another one, his name was Julio Izquierdo, a Spanish guy. And I'm not sure if he was Spanish. He might be Argentinian as well. And a little strange that both he and Nestor, their name is Izquierdo. But they seem to come from different areas, different countries. I mean, one was white, the other one was black, so I don't think they're related. But anyway, these two guys, they were in a group called, I forgot that now, but like I said, a group of assassins tracking down people. And these two as well are two of the assassins that were in Stockholm that day in February 1986. They were part of the hit team there as well. So, also, Michael Vernon Townley, he was the one, it seems like the one who killed the the Nobel Prize winning poet Pablo Neruda, who was killed just after the overtake of Pinochet. He was in the hospital, and then this doctor came in and gave him an injection in the stomach while he was asleep. And his name was, I can't remember what he was called, but he's been identified as being Michael Vernon Townley.
That's fascinating, because Chauncey Holt was hospitalized for an optical problem, and a fake doctor came in and gave him an injection of a massive injection of a blood thinner, and he actually bled to death internally.
It's awful. It's awful. Very similar. Very similar. I've been in touch with Chauncey Holt's daughter, and she told me about
Aaron,
these things.
Yeah, wonderful person.
So, yeah, and also they killed one guy in it's a very well-known case in South Africa, a doctor called Robert Smith, that Michael Townley and Virgilio Paz, and there was another guy also from Operation 40, they killed him in 78 or something like that. I mean, these guys have just been very, very active, and they're very... It's interconnected with this whole Stay Behind Gladio network system as well. So many of these terror acts, you know, they blow up the train station and whatever. These people pop up. If they're not active themselves, then they have trained the people doing it and so on. So I just find this Operation 40 very, very interesting.
You know, Ole, if you subtracted all the damage they've done around the world, it would be a different place. We'd be living; the atmosphere would be completely different, far more peaceful, tranquil, and humane.
I don't think there is such a thing as a real terrorist. I don't think, you know, I think whatever act, you know, if it's embassy bombings or whatever, blowing up the warehouses or Oklahoma City, whenever you look into it, you track back the same group. It backtracks to the same group again and again and again. Just different mechanics, but it's the same people behind it. And all the time, inside jobs being blamed on someone else.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's an instrument of political manipulation and control. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. It's a violent, bloody enforcer. That is just, and like you say, it's like a big bully in a schoolyard that is just terrorizing the neighborhood. If this elite stopped messing around with the world, it would just turn into a beautiful, beautiful place.
Yes.
That is what I think.
And now the looting and pillaging has gone so far that the United States may be on the verge of economic collapse. And, of course, you know, what's been going on in the Middle East is absolutely catastrophic, especially, you know, all these wars that the United States has been conducting on behalf of Israel to dismantle the modern, sophisticated Arab states and reduce them to little conflicting statelets so that Israel can have uncontested domination of the Middle East, which is the reason why it's so focused on Iran, because Iran is the counterweight to Israel, which it does not want to tolerate and wants to use the United States to dismantle. Do you know, Ole, that estimates have it that an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities would bring about the death of 1 million Iranians outright, and as a cloud of contamination swept across Afghanistan, Pakistan, and India would bring about another 35 million premature deaths? 36 million is six times the alleged, clearly exaggerated figure of 6 million Jews who were supposed to have died during the Holocaust.
But this is what the Iran is. Then is a new patsy. They really want. They're trying everything to get this going, you know. But we just have to wake up. I really. That's why I'm doing these things publicly. Is trying to wake people up to see what's going on, so that they don't buy into these things anymore. So that when a new mass shooting appears, or so-called mass shooting, or Boston Marathon, or beheading, that they stop up and just start watching, wait a second, what is going on? Where's the logic? You know, like, it's, for me, it's like, I see myself as a very simple person, you know, like a Farmer Brown mentality. 1 + 1 = 2. I don't care if you come in a white suit, white outfit with a name tag, and your name is Professor this and that, and you say 1 + 1 = 34. It does not. And when you look at these things, when you look at a crime scene like that, it's just, most of them are no-brainers once you start looking into it. It's just that we're being pumped with, no, this happened, and it is true because we're pumping it out through media. It is not. You know, it's so.
You're so right about the pattern that repeats itself. Have you looked at MLK, Martin Luther King, too?
God, yeah.
Tell me about Martin.
Can I, since time is scarce,
yes.
Can I go for the beheading in London?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm planning to bring you back already, Ole. Count on that.
Okay.
Count on that.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, go to the beheading, yeah, in Wilford.
No, because what I love with these things is that it seems that in the old days, when they did terror attacks, they actually did them, but so that people died. But it caused a lot of problems, because there's nothing as bad as having the mother of somebody who is massacred hanging, breathing down your neck, you know, because they'd never give up. You see the mothers in Argentina and so on. So every time you kill somebody or you torture someone to death and you just bury them in a hole and you think that's it, then you've got this family and the relatives that never, never quit. So I think that is one of the reasons why they started with these staged events where they use actors where they don't actually happen.
Oh, so there won't be parents and family who will pursue this relentlessly and indefinitely thereafter.
That's exactly my point. And I think that is why when you look at Aurora or Sandy Hook or the Boston Marathon or the one in London, these are perfect cases to look at as templates on how it's done and how it's so clumsily done nowadays. I mean, if I can go into some details
with
this in London, because it's absolutely hysterical, I think. Because also you need to look upon it. Somebody has been writing it's almost like a film script. How to make people emotionally involved, you know?
Yeah.
How to get the feelings. So this is why, for instance, this guy in England, the official story is that there was this soldier. He was not in uniform, but he was walking outside the barracks. It's in the middle of the city. And it's a very, there are lots of traffic normally. And the driving is on the left-hand side. And this day, this guy was walking outside the army barracks, and he had this T-shirt on where it says, Help for Heroes. Here comes the scenario. And these two black guys they thought, they said, oh my God, we will make a symbolic ritual killing or whatever. So officially they drive across the whole street from the left lane, across the traffic, meeting traffic, and they knock him down
with the car.
So that he's, and then they get out of the car and they pull out a big axe and a knife and they chop off his head and then they pull him out in the middle of the street. And then you got, I mean, this could happen, but once you start looking at it, okay, you got an army barrack where there's normally like hundreds of soldiers. If you look at this crime scene, the killers are there for like 25 minutes. There's no one coming out from the armor barracks. Both of the ends of the street is closed off. The surveillance cameras are turned off. There's no traffic. There's no traffic cues. There's no people honking. And in the background, you've got people like 100 meters from the so-called killer. And they're just standing, walking around, looking, you know, anyway. And then you got this woman with a shopping cart who just comes and walks and passes this guy with a big meat cleaver in his hand, you know, blood everywhere. She just passes him like 30 centimeters from him without even noticing him. So there's strange things here. And then these two so-called killers, they hang around for 25 minutes waiting for the police to arrive. And then when the police finally arrive, then they boom, 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 they get shot and taken away. First they're dead, then they survive, then they're dead, then, I mean, there's so many different variations of that. But when you start looking into it, I've been a background, what do you call it, actor in quite a lot of commercials,
yeah.
And
yes.
Some films.
An extra.
You know,
an extra.
I'm really good at sitting down on a park bench 100 meters from the camera, you know, doing nothing or walking across. Walking across the street.
That's one of your areas of specialization.
Exactly. And then if you see how that is done, the whole background action and the action in front of the camera is done, how you mark, you know, like their starting points, you start here, they make a point there, and you walk across there, they make a point there, you know. And then you got the extras, they're always driven there in a bus, all the extras. And then you got one truck that it normally comes with clothing and makeup and so on. And when you look at that street that is turned up, that is closed off there, what is closing it off? There's one big bus parked, and in front of it, there's a big white truck, exactly identical to the ones that normally brings clothing and makeup and these things. And the bus were for the extras. And then there's a cab that is parked as well, close, so there's no way for anyone to enter. And then they even made two cuts of the same, takes of the same episode, so it's not even filmed the same. So you got one where the guy is standing talking with his, he's standing there with a big axe and a knife in his hand and saying all of these things that, well, we see these horrible things happening in our home country every year, but now it's time for you to do experience the same. I'm sorry women had to see this. Don't listen to your government. They don't do want you anyway. Anyway, on the first take, there's absolutely no blood on his hands. Absolutely nothing. No blood stains, no nothing. On the second take, there's his hands are absolutely covered, not partly covered, but totally red painted, you know, on both sides. No blood stains on the clothes. And by the way, he's dressed all black. Do you know, like in the good old movies, the hero has always got a white hat and
yeah.
It's white, and the bad guy is black.
Yeah.
And black. Here, they're so black, these guys dressed in black. And the hero, when you see the pictures, I mean, you can't get any whiter in the skin. And he's got this red uniform with lots of medals on. And he's even a drummer, and his name is Rigby. Have you heard the Beatles name, Eleanor Rigby?
Sure, one of my favorites.
Yeah, exactly. So it appeals to the people's subconscious, you know. And then
I think it was just played. It will be played during the break, actually, just before this final segment. That's right.
There you go. Anyway, so the background action, that when you compare the two films, he's saying the same things, but his gestures are different, you know. And then also, one is with blood on his hand, one is without. But the background action is the same. The same woman is coming with the same shopping cart on both takes. So you explain.
So it's
that
obviously staged. It's a camera set. I mean, that's why the streets are blocked off. Why nobody's really paying attention? They know it's a dummy. They know the whole thing is a fabrication and a fake.
Exactly. And then there's absolutely no blood on the body in the middle of the street. The guy who's filming, when after the killer, he stops talking, he walks across the street, and you can even see the markings in the street. Walk from here to over there. There's the white dots, you know. So he walks across, and then you got this woman who is apparently approaching the killer saying, "Oh my God, what have you done?" Totally calm, not hysterical in any way. And do you know what she does? She lies down next to the body without a head. She lies down next to it, totally calm, and gets up again and starts talking to the guy. I mean, come on, it's so badly done. And then the
it's clearly a film set, you know, and then it's being promoted as though it were an actual event.
That's what I'm saying. And then you got where they chopped off the head officially. There's no blood on the film version, no nothing. But then when there's aerial photos, there's blood added, you know, where the body is supposed to be dragged. There's no blood.
Ole, this has been fascinating. I don't know when I've enjoyed an interview more than I have this. I'm eager to get you back, and I can't thank you enough. This is Jim Fetzer, your host, thanking my special guest today, Ole Damegaard, for being here, and all of you for listening.
Up the rice in the church where a wedding has been. Lives in a dream, waits at the window, wearing the face that she keeps in a jar by the door. Who is it for? All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong? Father Mackenzie, writing the words of a sermon that no one will hear. No one comes near, look at him working, darning his socks in the night when there's nobody there. What does he care? All the lonely people, where do they all come from? All the lonely people, where do they all belong? Church and was buried along with her name. Nobody came. Father Mackenzie, wiping the dirt from his hands as he walks from the grave. No one was saved. All the lonely people. Where do they all come from? All the lonely people. Where do they all belong?
Trouble seems so far away. Now it looks as though we're here to stay. I believe in yesterday.